This is Friday, February 1st, 2019. We are in Natick, Massachusetts, and this tape is part of the Morse Institute Library's continuing Veterans Oral History Project. My name is Maureen Sullivan, and we are privileged to have with us today Arthur Robert. Welcome, Arthur.
Thank you.
May I ask when you were born?
I was born on September 11th, 1964.
And where were you born?
Manchester, New Hampshire.
And what community do you currently live in?
Natick, Massachusetts.
Your marital status?
I'm married, happily.
Do you have children?
I have two.
Any grandchildren yet?
No, my two children are in college. That will come in time. Yes.
And tell us about life in Manchester, New Hampshire.
Well, I grew up in Manchester in the 1960s and 70s. Now, the city at the time was still recovering from the closure of the Enniskeg Mills in the 1930s. The mills dominated the community and dominated the economy. And with the closure of the mills, the economy really hadn't recovered at that point. And I think many people and many families were still trying to find their way.
And what did your father do for a living?
My father is a plumber.
And your mother?
My mother's primary occupation was raising the family. I'm one of 12 children, and that was her focus until about the point when I was in high school, at which point she started working in the retail world.
Did you go to schools in Manchester?
I did.
And during that time, were you made aware of events happening, especially the Vietnam War?
The answer is yes. Mm-hmm. I don't think it was necessarily presented to me. I think I've always had an interest in what was going on in the world around me. And I recall even as early as third grade trying to understand what was happening in Vietnam. And I recall putting together a fairly sophisticated project for school all about it. And at one time, I did have one of those POW bracelets that was a result of that.
So when and where did you enter the military?
I entered the military while I was still in high school in 1981. I enlisted in the United States Army Reserve. And prior to graduation, I drilled with the unit on weekends.
Mm-hmm. And what made you choose the Army?
Well, I think I've always had the sense of the importance of serving in some way. My father served during the Korean conflict as a Marine. Leaving college as a platoon leader corps student to do his part. And prior to that, my grandfather and my great uncle both served during World War I. So I think for me, there was always a sense that I would have to do my part. I can't say I was really sure what that meant, but I think from the outset, at least some role in the military would be important.
So what happened after you graduated from Manchester? I'm assuming Manchester High School?
Well, Central High School in Manchester.
Oh, okay.
Actually, I have three. Mm-hmm. But after graduating from high school, I think 2 days later, I was on a bus heading for basic training, U.S. Army basic training at Fort Dix, New Jersey.
And was this the first time you were away from home?
It was the longest stretch being away from home. Mm-hmm. But prior to that, I think I had spent maybe a week away as a Boy State participant in high school.
So tell us a bit about BASIC.
It's attention getting. BASIC has the unique characteristics of stripping away a lot of the, I'm not going to use good words here, but BASIC has a way of stripping away a lot of the veneers and the airs and the social constructs that separate us. I was thrown into a platoon of maybe 50 people, including a combination of reservists that were heading for college, like myself, and a large group of black and Puerto Rican new soldiers who were largely either in gangs or escaping from gangs in communities like Jersey City. So it was a melting pot where we had to figure out how to work together very quickly. And along the way, a lot of the trappings of society that divided us were forcibly stripped away.
Mm-hmm. So tell us how long were you in BASIC?
It was 9 weeks. It was essentially for the duration of the summer.
And, a very hot summer, I assume.
Well, I think anybody who goes through basic training in the summer would argue that it's been the hottest it's ever been. Fort Dix is at least at the time was known for having lots of beach sand laid on the trails and at the different ranges. So that as part of the conditioning process, when you're out marching from point A to point B, would kick up a lot of dust. And if you weren't in the first platoon in the company formation, you would be behind, dealing with the heat. The humidity, which was really tough that summer, as well as tremendous, tremendous dust.
So after 9 weeks of sand, dust, whatever, mm-hmm. What happened next?
Well, on completing basic training, on graduation, I returned home and started college at the University of New Hampshire. And I also enrolled in the ROTC program while I continued to serve concurrently as an Army reservist.
Mm-hmm. And tell us what that was like.
That's a broad question.
Well, having gone to college myself in that period down at UMass Amherst, I knew that those who were in the ROTC program weren't exactly the big men on campus. Was it the same way up there?
Well, my recollection is that the ROTC program had been reestablished on campus only within the previous 5 years. Mm-hmm. And the cadet battalion was not very large. I think that certainly the cadets collectively, we formed a pretty tight community. I think you could argue that our outlook maybe was a little bit more different than the students around us. I think generally, my sense is that we were a little bit more focused. What are some other ways to characterize it? For me, coming from basic training to a college environment, I had a pretty strong sense of the importance of autonomy and control after having surrendered so much of that during basic training, that I think I had a strong set of preferences that led me, how can I put this, running in a direction somewhat counter to many of my peers.
Arthur, what was your major at UNH?
Political science. Okay. And I studied I completed a number of economics courses as well.
And did you graduate from UNH?
I did in 1986.
But you also continued your Army reservist?
Correct. I earned a commission as a second lieutenant in 1984 and continued to serve with my unit, drilling on weekends and taking part in annual training.
Okay. I just wanted to clarify. This is the Army Reserve?
Correct.
But not the National Guard?
Correct.
Okay, Army Reserve. And where would you normally train?
Well, my unit of assignment was located in Manchester, New Hampshire, so we spent a fair amount of time at our Army Reserve Center. But during field training, we did go to a number of different locations. Fort Devens, the Air Force has a space tracking facility in New Boston, New Hampshire, Rochester, New Hampshire, other locations. When on active duty, locations included Fort Benning, Georgia, Fort Dix, New Jersey, and Fort Campbell, Kentucky.
Mm-hmm. And did you have any kind of specialty?
I was commissioned as an infantry officer.
And you actually were in the Army in the 1980s when it was undergoing a very deep transitional period when the uniforms started changing, even the food was starting to change. What were your recollections on that?
Well, it's an interesting question because I think the shift to the all-volunteer force in the leadership that assumed control of the Army in the wake of the Vietnam War, there's a huge push for modernization, a huge push for professionalization. As a reservist at that time, we were never really a priority for equipment. But one thing that always has struck me about the military, starting from that point, was a tremendous focus on training and professional development. Either being sent away on active duty for training, for example, I completed the Field Artillery Officer Basic Course in 1987, which was, as I recall, about 5 months of learning the science of artillery and the art of leadership. But prior to that and since, there were certainly many different opportunities to get training to learn more about what it means to be an effective soldier, as well as learning more about what it takes to be an effective leader. And that focus and that emphasis was very clear, even given my role in a unit that wasn't a high priority organization. I served in a mobilization training company, which is a long way of saying I was part of a company of drill sergeants, and our mission was on mobilization to go to a training center like Fort Benning and take over a basic training company and run it, and run several cycles of soldiers through basic training. Mm-hmm. So we had to know what it meant to be a soldier. We had to develop an understanding of leadership as well as an understanding of the Army culture to properly transition new recruits, you know, into effective soldiers.
Now, Arthur, during this period, did you have a civilian job?
Well, certainly after I graduated, I had a number of different jobs. My thought was always to pursue additional civilian education. So in 1989, I was accepted into the International Relations Program at Syracuse University. I actually put off attending for a year to raise the money to do it. Mm-hmm. And I enrolled in the fall of 1990.
And then the following year, something happened.
Correct.
And that something happened to be the Persian Gulf War.
Yes, correct.
So take it away and tell us what happened.
Well, it's an interesting story because attending graduate school has its own demands and challenges. Excuse me, I remained in the Army Reserve, and I transferred to a unit in Syracuse, New York, not far from the school. That was the 403rd Civil Affairs Company, a very different organization, a very different mission, and one that took a while to really fully appreciate. Moving from a culture defined by drill sergeants, standards, preparing individuals for combat, to an organization that was all about helping a military commander effectively manage relationships with and obligations to a civilian population that inevitably is part of a combat zone. Mm-hmm. So instead of dealing with folks, drill sergeants who understood weapons, understood how to train in hand-to-hand combat as examples, I had to get comfortable working with soldiers who actually brought different skills to work on different problems. Bankers, lawyers, stockbrokers, municipal managers that on deployment would perform very different functions. And that is to help make sure communities function, that basic needs were being met, and that commanders understood the civilian population around them. So as you can imagine, the transition from working with drill sergeants who are very sharp, very focused, to this very different kind of soldier who are more focused on their civilian attributes than their military training and skills was a little jarring, mm-hmm. especially for a young lieutenant like myself.
So take us into the early part of 1991, when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait.
Well, if I've thought about this, and I think for me, the appropriate point of departure for this was actually the previous, I believe it was the previous winter, mm-hmm. where I was able to work on a few days of active duty for my unit. And I was asked to update the unit's mobilization files. Every unit in the reserves or in the National Guard has a mobilization plan that basically enables the transition from what's called inactive status to active status. And there are many different elements of that plan that relate to personnel, intelligence, operations, and logistics that need to be pretty much set to ease that transition from inactive to active status. Mm-hmm. I focused on the operational piece, and I found that the unit really wasn't fully preparing for its post-mobilization training, meaning training that's completed after being called to duty but before being deployed. Mm-hmm. And I spent a lot of time updating that to be sure that the unit, if it ever were to be mobilized, would be able to access the resources it needs and set aside the time that it needs to be sure that we are able to, A, perform our mission, but just as important, survive and protect ourselves on the battlefield. So having done that, I guess I never really thought much of it until the following August. And during August, I did have some active duty time again, and I guess there are two interesting or two points that stand out, you know, not long after the invasion took place. The first was while doing some work, television was on. Everybody wanted to know what was happening, and there was a moment when then President Bush was asked a few questions about what was happening before getting on a helicopter. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't really clear what anybody should expect, but after he answered questions, he basically offered a phrase akin to, you know, this invasion of Kuwait will not stand. In my mind, at that point, it was just a matter of time. Mm-hmm. And very interestingly, several days later, while still on active duty, I paid a visit to our unit's mobilization site or mobilization station. As part of that mobilization planning process, units typically visit their mobilization site every year and make sure that they have relationships with the mobilization staff and provide and share updates with regard to mobilization plans. Well, you can imagine, you know, at that point, that kind of visit would not likely be as perfunctory as you might think. And while it was long planned, we did visit, myself and a staff sergeant that was also assigned to the unit. The visit to the mobilization officer's office was eye-opening, to say the least. As you might expect, there was a lot of chaos, pandemonium almost, in terms of equipment being moved, maps being put up, at that time acetate overlays being placed on maps, phones ringing, people talking urgently. Well, when we got to our mobilization officer's desk, we talked a little bit, exchanged pleasantries. Then, as we were doing this, I could not help but notice that on his desk, there were three stacks of paper. A short one, let's say one of intermediate size, short may have been an inch, intermediate, let's just say two, and the big one was 4 inches. So as a lieutenant at the time, maybe I was a little impertinent, but I couldn't help but ask, so, you know, what are these stacks? And the response was, these stacks represent the lists of units that could be mobilized, you know, for war in the future. And at that point, I couldn't help but ask the follow-up question, is our unit in any of these stacks? And he looked me straight in the eye and he said, you're in all of them. So I had to take that secret back, shared that information with my operations officer in a walk around his neighborhood, and had to carry that knowledge while completing a semester of school, which wasn't an easy thing to do. I don't think my wife will ever forgive me for not telling her, but it was just a stark reality. And from that point forward, it was clear to me that I had to do everything I could do to physically and professionally prepare and do the best to help my unit do the same.
So when did the call come?
The call came just before Christmas. I was working as an intern in the Niagara Mohawk Power Corporation, which at the time was a large independent company headquartered in Syracuse. And I got a call from someone I had never met before. And at the time, an alert order would be shared by telephone, would be used two code words. One, if it was just a practice, the code words were grazing herd. And if it was for real, it was a roaring bull. So for this person I'd never met before, he called and introduced himself and said right from the front, "This is a roaring bull message." So I said, "Okay, thank you. Where do I need to be and when?" Hung up my phone, turned off my computer, packed up my desk, and left. And we were mobilized, I believe it was on the 27th of December, a day or two after Christmas. So I did have the opportunity to spend Christmas with my family, which meant driving from Syracuse to Manchester, then Manchester back out to Syracuse to start the process. Which during winter, as you know, can be a dicey proposition, but it was fine. There were no real weather issues.
And where were you mobilized?
We were sent to Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Our mobilization station was to be Fort Meade, Maryland, but our unit was reassigned to the United States Army Civil Affairs and Psychological Operations Command. So we were considered in some basic way a special operations asset as a result of that reassignment. So we were sent to their headquarters, and we did about a month of post-mobilization training at Fort Bragg.
So that takes us to late January 1991. Mm-hmm. What happens next?
I can't put my finger on the date, but inevitably the time to go was what arrived. We were sent to Pope Air Force Base, which is on the opposite side of Fort Bragg. Mm-hmm. And when our time came, I believe it was like 3 or 4 in the morning, we all took our turns climbing onto one of two C-5s, C-5A Galaxies. That our unit was assigned that kind of transportation asset, you know, reflected a very high priority. I think that the folks very high above our level wanted to be sure that as the American Army got involved in a very different environment, that commanders had what they needed to manage not just a different people and culture, but urban settings, specifically Kuwait City. What I remember most about that moment was as we gathered our equipment and our weapons and headed for the plane to climb the ladder to get inside, get on board, we were surrounded, each flank of our approach to the aircraft were lined by military policemen. So it was certainly time to go, and the fact that you didn't have an option was very, very clear. Not that it was an issue for me, but it was just a very clear sign of the gravity or the magnitude of what we were getting involved in.
All right, you're on a C-5. You're heading out of North Carolina. Where did you guys touch down?
We touched down in Massachusetts very briefly. What's the air base that's just north of Chicopee?
Oh, Edwards?
No, that's on the Cape.
Oh, yeah.
Well, we stopped briefly in Massachusetts. Then we flew on to Torreon, Spain. We stayed on the ground for a few hours, you know, for aircraft maintenance, refuel, et cetera. What was another indicator of just how big what was going on was these planes don't have big windows, but occasionally, you know, I could muscle up to one and see what was going on around me. I recall counting something like 30 C-5 tails, which I think at the time the United States had maybe 90 of them, which meant a huge part of our air transport fleet, you know, the most precious assets were involved, and we were part of it. So that was another, you know, attention-getting kind of moment.
All right, and from Spain to?
We flew on to ultimately Saudi Arabia. We landed at an airfield outside of an industrial community known as Al Jubal. We landed in daylight, and it was because you're flying inside a dark aircraft for so long, the first sensation or thought was something like a Capricorn One moment. Do you recall that movie?
Somewhat, yes.
The movie was, as I recall it, was all about essentially a staged space mission to Mars that was all executed, you know, on film. It wasn't for real, and the public was being deceived. What really struck me about flying all of the, being in that plane for so long and not seeing anything, finally landing on the ground, we were able to, you know, get personnel, we were able to get off the plane. We had to figure out how we were going to move our equipment off, but the first step was to get the people off the plane. My first observation was, you know, this can't be anything, we can't possibly be on the other side of the world. It felt like we had just been in a box and the box opened and being out on airfield, I was thinking, well, maybe we're in California. It's just a jarring kind of juxtaposition going from a really dark place where you couldn't see anything forever to suddenly out onto this open tarmac surrounded by desert on each side. It didn't take long for us to understand that, you know, in fact, we were someplace very different when the first air raid alarm went off. For us, we weren't really sure what to expect, but we could see that people on the airfield, the airmen that were staffing the airfield, once the alarm was given, they wasted no time running for shelter, running for bunkers. And I think it was at that point we realized, you know, we weren't in Kansas, so to speak, anymore. It was all for real. At that point, the Iraqis were launching Scud missiles from positions in Iraq that were striking in different locations in Kuwait. It was a false alarm, at least for us, but it was certainly attention getting.
So tell us a little bit about the uniform and some of the equipment that you had. First of all, the uniform, were you wearing a battle uniform?
Well, folks, soldiers in the Army have a duty uniform, which for at the time was called the battle dress uniform. It was a green camouflage pair of pants and a blouse. I mean, that's the basis of it. Now, we hadn't received any issue of equipment specific for that part of the world, so we left North Carolina essentially with the equipment that we had, which was oriented towards fighting in Europe. So in addition to the basic uniform, we had pretty much the basic load of what we would carry as individual soldiers. A harness and a web belt that supported two canteens, an entrenching tool, ammo pouches, first aid kit. We also had carried a gas mask, and we were also carried a chemical protective overgarment, so that if needed, you know, we had them immediately available. And what was another point that was definitely different, unlike stateside service, you know, we were issued bayonets.
That is unusual.
Which is another indicator of, you know, being in theater and having a prospects for being involved in something very serious. You know, other differences included, as part of the chemical preparedness, being issued atropine auto-injectors, so that if you were to be afflicted with a chemical agent, atropine is a drug that accelerates the body's processing of whatever's in it, with the goal of getting it out. Again, something you don't typically see. Mm. There are other things too, but mm-hmm. In addition to that, of course, we all had a helmet to protect ourselves from, you know, head injuries.
Right. Okay, your first days in Saudi Arabia. Now, were you kind of put in a special part of the field, or were you being combined with other units?
Well, there was a lot of confusion, and I think our ultimate mission was somewhat different than most units. There was confusion in part because we were a United States Army asset, but we were our wartime mission was to be assigned to the headquarters of the 1st Marine Expeditionary Force. As you might expect, there was some confusion and communication around that. So the first couple of days were spent in part acclimatizing and adjusting to the, you know, the huge time difference. But in part, I think our leaders and the Marine Corps leaders were trying to figure out what to do with us. Meaning, where do you billet people? How are they going to draw rations? Where are they going to seek shelter if there's an air raid? Those sorts of things, and it wasn't easily resolved. But I can tell you that our first experience with Marine Corps food created a new motivation to find a different solution. The sea rations that we were offered were absolutely horrible. And it's funny how something like that can drive ingenuity to find a different solution.
Mm-hmm. I am a little surprised, because I believe by that time the sea rations were being phased out in favor of the first generation MREs.
Well, let me be clear. You're right about that. Mm-hmm. But the hot food that is served to Marines while on board boats while deployed is hot. It's not in individual pouches or bags. It's, you know, it's designed to serve units. Mm-hmm. But it was clearly, you know, the first priority is always for making sure that it's shelf stable. And it was pretty bad. It was definitely a morale blow.
All right.
So that motivated our command to find a different place, different location, a different support relationship to help the unit do what it help the units be supported while the unit executed its mission, which was to support the Marine Corps headquarters.
And did your command find a different spot?
Yes.
Okay.
After, if I recall, better part of a week, we were able to fall in on Army contracted housing, essentially work camp housing that was occupied by foreign laborers who were working in nearby petrochemical plants. We were able to fall in on some vacant space. So we had a separate place, we had a secure location, we had a clear idea of where to go and call our home, whatever you want to call it. And critically, we had access to an Army serviced mess hall, which was actually, you know, by comparison, you know, it was good. It was mm-hmm. adequate. The key thing was that there was always some fresh fruit available. I mean, regardless of whatever else was in the mix, you had that piece to keep yourself happy and regular.
Okay, Arthur, tell us what happened next. You're in Saudi Arabia. You're pretty much settled.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see. Now we're talking. How far along in 1991?
Well into the air war.
Okay.
So what's really striking about this experience is that a lot happened in a short amount of time, and I think a lot of people didn't really process it, didn't really have time to process it, including myself. But we spent our time as an organization working with the Marine Corps headquarters. Any headquarters in any military organization has elements that focus on personnel, intelligence, operations, and logistics. Civil affairs is a function within operations, especially at a high headquarters. The Marine Expeditionary Force level, if I recall correctly, is a 3-star command. So it's a very high level. And the headquarters, by definition, is robust because a 3-star general has tremendous reach and needs a lot of help mm-hmm. in managing the assets mm-hmm. under control. Mm-hmm. And we got involved in various aspects of planning for the liberation of Kuwait. You know, from the relatively mundane aspects of identifying resources to be brought into country, planning for the transport of those, identifying who the receiving parties or entities would be. Mm-hmm. And there was also some engagement with the Iraqi resistance within the country.
Mm-hmm. And did you yourself have any encounter with the Iraqi resistance or any of the locals?
Certainly with many locals in Saudi Arabia and eventually mm-hmm. Kuwait, but never any direct interaction with folks in the resistance.
Okay. So now we're talking about, you just mentioned the air war that was mm-hmm. taking place. But your units were getting ready for a ground offensive, correct?
Correct.
And when did that ground offense start?
It was the end of February.
Okay.
I can't put my... I apologize. I did not go back and look at timelines and whatnot.
That's okay.
But a lot of our initial work was what you could call staff work,
mm-hmm.
working with different elements of the high mm-hmm. command. But as we approached, as the ground war date mm-hmm. approached... Well, we didn't know exactly what it was. Okay. Our unit was eventually to be broken down and attached to subordinate headquarters.
Okay.
So we were eventually staged further north from Al Jubal, mm-hmm. through a small town called Kafji or Al Kafji, and then heading first west and then north into the Marine Corps' staging areas mm-hmm. in Saudi Arabia, just outside of the Kuwait border.
Okay. And I understand you have a map.
I do. Well, I have maps, yes.
Okay. Why don't you...
They're really kind of silly. They're not tactical maps, but there may be one or two that could be useful.
Okay.
I mean, this is a...
All right.
This provides a little bit of a view.
Okay, if you can just a little bit higher, if you will, please.
Of course, if that helps.
All right. Just a skosh higher, please. Excellent. Okay, so where were you located first?
Well, the city of Al Jubal, or the port of Al Jubal, is a bit further south,
uh-huh.
just off the map. When it was our time to move forward north, we moved through a small town called Al Kafji, which was... Mm-hmm. subject of a brigade level fight or Iraqi incursion just before the ground war started.
Yeah.
We saw some evidence of that and we passed through it.
Mm-hmm.
But we ultimately spent a lot of time in convoy on compacted sand roads running generally west and then north to, you know, the Marine staging areas, which is mm-hmm. roughly there.
And of course Kuwait City is right there.
Here, just for the purpose, yeah. Just to get folks located. This is the Kuwait border defined mm-hmm. in black here.
And of course at the time, when you were there, were you given regular updates as what was happening?
No. We had a general sense of what was happening operationally, but the specifics one would hope for, I think, never arrive, at least in my military experience. You get bits and pieces, and as time goes on, you're able to put together a picture. But there was, I wouldn't call it so much confusion, but there was a lot of anticipation, maybe uninformed anticipation. You know, being deployed forward, waiting for our call to make the next moves. Now, the Marines had moved through from their positions, you know, basically south, north and east, you know, towards Kuwait City. And instead of a major fight that was anticipated, it was pretty lopsided. So the combat phase, you know, for the Marines here, the EPAC forces here, and the bulk of the United States Army, which moved this way, it was fast and furious, you know, 100 hours. So we were in position expecting first to support the Marine Corps in a combat mission, but it ended very quickly. Mm-hmm. So there was a rapid transition to restoring order and setting conditions for reconstruction in Kuwait. Excuse me. Mm-hmm. And our unit got involved in different aspects of that, you know, primarily organizing and leading convoys of relief equipment and relief supplies, you know, into Kuwait City.
When you were heading into Kuwait City, and I've seen a lot of the photos of this trail of destruction that was left by the end of the air war, did you see any of that?
Well, yes, but I think let me try to put that in context. A lot of what people saw on television actually did not happen in Kuwait City itself. It happened outside the city along a highway heading first west and then north towards the Iraqi border. The city itself, you know, my primary impressions included the fact that it was obviously run down from the lack of good public services over many months. It had a smell of decay that I think could be, you know, could be explained for a number of reasons. there were neighborhoods that were primarily Palestinian that were surrounded by Arab forces with their weapons facing into the neighborhoods, which said something about the level of trust, at least, you know, based on the information that was available on the ground at the time, in that there were other efforts on the part of the Iraqis to prepare different parts of the city for a defense, but they weren't generally well developed or well implemented. It seemed to me that there was just as much effort put into setting up roadblocks and controls directed at the civilian population, more oriented towards occupation than defense. So was the city itself heavily damaged? There was certainly war-related damage, but I think that there was a lot of effort invested into, you know, managing the threat of the possibility of civilian casualties. And the Iraqi army that was the target was very much in the field, either in Kuwait or, in the case of the Republican Guard, a good chunk of it was still in Iraq. So this idea of destruction, yeah, it was a war-torn city, but it wasn't the subject of intense aerial attack. It wasn't the subject of an intense ground battle.
Mm-hmm. So Arthur, now your units are in north and west of Kuwait City. Is that correct?
Well, we were south and west in Saudi Arabia. We were pushed forward into Kuwait City, mm-hmm. and took up space, or took up residence, if you will, on the grounds of the education, Kuwaitia Education Ministry. If I recall correctly, a good chunk of that was in parking garages and things like that, mm-hmm. where we had a place to call home, get organized, and execute the missions that we were assigned.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of missions were they?
Well, as I said before, they were primarily oriented on moving supplies into the country. Our echelons above us were very much involved in discussions with the Kuwaiti government about what kind of assistance was needed. And I think as a rule, while they appreciated help at, we call the tactical level, helping to move things and get things organized, I think that there was a certain element of pride that left them reluctant to have get assistance in terms of reorganizing government or reestablishing governmental authority and making the different aspects of government work. It's, you know, essentially the core strengths of my units and the mission that it has.
Mm-hmm. And how long were you in Kuwait City?
I'm thinking, it wasn't long, 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks. What was really striking about what was happening is that it took a long time to build up the forces to fight the fight, but there seemed to be an intense interest to get people out and start moving equipment out as quickly as possible. Mm-hmm. I mean, the deployment was just it's hard to express, you know, the size of it. Different indicators we saw were you referred to, you know, these meals ready to eat. One vision I recall seeing while doing our work, driving in the desert in Saudi Arabia, seeing essentially a wall of MREs, you know, boxes stacked together, I would say 7, 8, 10 feet tall, and what looked like at least 100 yards in length.
Wow.
Now, another indicator, you know, while we were in El Jubal, we weren't allowed to enter the port, and, you know, for operational reasons. The priority of the port was to move the Army 7th Corps, you know, from Europe to Saudi Arabia. And every night, while we couldn't see, we could hear what seemed like endless convoys of vehicles leaving and heading north and west of our location.
During the time you were in Kuwait City, you were mentioning Scud missiles earlier. Did you see, hear anything in the way?
At that point, no.
No?
But okay. Earlier, there were plenty of alerts, and one of the interesting things we learned about the alerts was that the systems that were set up to detect the launches, when there was a detection, the alert went out throughout the theater. So everybody got the word, and everybody would take cover until they could get a better sense of, well, what is the actual trajectory and what's the actual strike point. So there were a lot of alerts, and inevitably, you know, folks begin to think after a while, you know, it's not going to happen to me. We had one while we were in Al Jubal explode maybe a mile and a half away. It was certainly something that you could hear, and it was loud. It wasn't a physical danger, but it was one of those attention-getting moments.
So what happened after spending 2 to 3 weeks in Kuwait City?
Well, as I said before, there was a push to move units out of theater, and we were tasked to move from Kuwait City to Al Jubal, and after spending, I'm guessing, about 2 weeks there, we were given orders to move further south to a city called Al Kobar. We were at that point, it was pretty clear that there was no additional mission for us. Unlike many other conflicts, there wasn't a big refugee challenge. Civil affairs units typically get involved in managing refugee issues. And for Kuwait, you know, a lot of people left. The people who stayed, but the people who left typically were people of means. They had left to other capitals in the Middle East, and it was safe to come back. They came back on their own. So with that in mind, the presumption was that there was no mission for us, so that we were ordered to move back. And we spent about, I'm thinking about 2 weeks preparing to leave country, mm-hmm. which means turning in ammunition we didn't need, turning in the atropine auto injectors that we weren't having a need for anymore, mm-hmm. preparing our vehicles for shipment, making decisions about what to do with our tentage. There are strict rules in terms of what can be shipped out and what can be accepted out of a theater and be accepted back in the United States. So vehicles had to be cleaned. Tentage, I think, generally was not kept. It was disposed of. And along the way, everything had to be accounted for. People, weapons, all the equipment that we had.
I'm just kind of curious, Arthur, how many personnel would that be in your case?
Well, as a civil affairs company, I recall we had maybe 100 people.
100 people, okay.
With a diverse range of skills, very much the opposite of an infantry rifle company where you have maybe 120 soldiers, but most of them having some kind of infantry skill or set. Mm-hmm. Mission very different, personalities very different as a result.
So once equipment's accounted for, personnel accounted for, when did you leave?
Well, oftentimes in the military, you probably heard people use the term or phrase "hurry up and wait." Mm-hmm. Well, when folks are leaving, they're much more motivated, and we are prepared to go much more quickly to go home than we were to head to theater. Mm-hmm. The actual slotting of aircraft and whatnot was something that we weren't really given access to until pretty much the last moment, when I think we had maybe 3 hours notice when our turn was to come. And of course, our unit was spread out. We had people going out doing different things, and we had to bring them all back and get them on the bus, literally, so that we could be ready for our aircraft. That involved, as I recall, like I said, getting on buses at dusk, mm-hmm. arriving at an airfield and waiting on the airfield, on the side of the runway, for maybe 6 or 7 hours before our plane landed and mm-hmm. we had our chance to board.
Just to step back a little bit, did you have an opportunity to send a message to your family? Did you write letters or?
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
Of course. There's always time to make for that.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point in time, there was at least occasional access to phone booths in some of these locations. The only way you could talk to someone is account for the many hours of a time mm-hmm. difference. So you had to be very careful about when you could actually get to one.
Yeah. Of course, the Persian Gulf War was just a few years before email got fully developed, so
correct.
It almost seems like another time and place,
well,
so to speak.
In some respects, I think that's fair.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think there were something like 500,000 of us who were involved in some way, and you know, our role was small and not, in the big scheme of things, not really important, and we didn't really have the exposure to combat that many other folks had. But I think just the same, I would call it an experience that's defining, at once defining mm-hmm. and isolating.
Before we get you on the plane heading mm-hmm. back to the United States, is there anything else that you recall about your experiences in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait?
I can share a few. In one case, we had the opportunity to join a Saudi family for dinner during Ramadan. During Ramadan, among other things, you know, it's an important period in the Islamic faith, where during the day is characterized by fasting and the evening is characterized by feasting. We had the opportunity to visit an apartment, several of us, in the unit had the opportunity to visit with a Saudi family, a young doctor, a young nurse, who also had two young children. And it was very interesting to hear their perspectives about what's happening in their country and their hopes for the future. And another piece I think that was kind of illuminating was the juxtaposition between Saudi Arabia as a very conservative, arguably puritanical kind of place. We had the opportunity while we were in Al-Khobar to hop on a bus, cross the causeway to Bahrain, which just I think maybe 6 miles by bus and bridge was a very different place. Very much more colorful, very much more liberal. Alcohol was freely available. And it was interesting to observe the number of Saudi men who were amongst us that were escaping from or complimenting, you know, their lives in Saudi Arabia. It seemed a little hypocritical, let me just put it that way. And at the time, there just seemed to be hopes for change that obviously have only slowly unfolded in recent years.
All right, so Arthur, you're finally on the plane, and the plane takes off. Where did you guys land?
Well, there's some interesting insights. That was an interesting flight. First of all, it was really rough. So it seems to all of us that the Army was trying to find a way to deal us its last, or extract its last elements of pain. But we were on a civilian 747, which was really interesting. We had to board with our equipment and our weapons, and it was unusual to hear the stewardess ask us to kindly stow our weapons under our seat. You know, not something you typically talk about while flying. And our unit, as part on the 747, I mean, there were other folks, other units that were on this plane, including soldiers from the 82nd Airborne Division. It was very interesting to see how people would spend time. You know, us as reservists trying to find opportunities to sleep, catch up on letter writing and whatnot, while our counterparts from the 82nd Airborne Division were, you know, hard at work cleaning their weapons at, you know, 35,000 feet, you know, amongst the seats. And the other really striking moment, one of the striking moments just in this whole process, we knew it was safe or that it was ending. First, when we were told that we had flown out of Saudi airspace, and the second was they served dinner on the plane. You know, airplane food back then wasn't anything to write home about, but the Dutch butter was something that I hadn't experienced in you know, many months, and it was again a sure sign of like returning to reality. Of course, flying back, we landed in the Netherlands. We weren't allowed off the plane. From there, we flew on. We actually stopped in Boston, which was pretty exciting, but they wouldn't let us outside of the exterior lounge areas. So even while being in the United States, we hadn't cleared customs. So, you know, we tried calling our significant others, you know, to try to arrange a meeting, but, you know, there was that gap. We were separated from the real world by, you know, those roll down garage doors, but, you know, there's plenty of gaps in between the rods. So it still felt like it was a good example of still being in a cage, if you will, of this whole experience.
So when did they let you loose?
It was mid-April when we were finally done. We had to return to Fort Bragg. We had to turn in all our equipment. We had exit physical exams, and then it was our turn to leave. We took commercial flight back to Syracuse, New York.
And you actually continued to stay in the Army Reserves.
Yes.
And you actually went through the ranks to Lieutenant Colonel.
Correct.
Were you doing pretty much the same duties?
Well, I stayed with that unit for another 5 years, but in 1991, at the end of the summer, I had finished my studies at Syracuse. My wife and I decided to get married, and we had some choices to make. She grew up in Cohasset. I grew up in Manchester, New Hampshire, and we chose Natick as a location that seemed to be, you know, in terms of drive time anyway, pretty central, while offering good access to Boston and whatever else might come. We thought it would be a good central location to start from. And by 1995, I had moved from the Army Reserve to the Massachusetts National Guard and served in the Guard for about 10 years before retiring in 2005.
So you were with the Mass National Guard when 9/11 happened.
Correct.
And tell us about that.
It was an interesting time. It was trying. Again, an example of a time when there was a lot of chaos. There was a lot of uncertainty about what our roles might be in part of what would be a much bigger response that frankly unfolded over the course of years. Early on, I was part of planning for sending National Guard soldiers to New York City to provide security, something that, you know, contingency that didn't unfold. At that point, you know, as a staff officer and as a major, I spent a lot of time updating contingency plans regarding terrorist response and what the National Guard role, the role of specific units in the National Guard might be. And those are examples, and certainly as time wore on, the Army had needs for individual soldiers and eventually units. And, you know, in the course of my workday, I would get calls, you know, with questions being asked about how to handle some of those asks.
Now, I had, not too long ago, I had another officer who had served in the Mass National Guard, and he had not only went through 2001, but he also was at the Mass, the Democratic National Convention in Boston in 2004, and of course, when the Red Sox won the World Series. Were you involved in any of those, or at least helped?
No. I was assigned to different units in the Massachusetts National Guard that were part of the artillery community. And, you know, we had individuals assigned to perform specific missions, but I was not deeply involved in planning for those kinds of things.
Okay. And where were you stationed, or at least when you were on active duty or on weekends, where would you go?
Well, I actually started in Lexington, then New Bedford, Massachusetts, Quincy, Massachusetts, and Rehoboth.
So you left the Army Reserves, Mass National Guard, rank of Lieutenant Colonel. Did you earn any medals or commendations?
Well, along the way, I think three Army Commendation Medals, three Army Achievement Medals. While deployed, actually the National Defense Service Medal twice, Southwest Asia Service Medal, and, you know, I'm sure there are others. One that stands out is because we served with the Marines in the 1st Marine Expeditionary Force, we were awarded something called the Naval Unit Commendation Medal, which is uncommon to see in the Army community.
It is unusual.
Yeah, and it's something that I think helped anybody stand out, and it was definitely a conversation starter, you know, amongst people in uniform.
Okay. So, Arthur, did you join any military service organization such as the VFW or the Legion?
I'm an American Legion member. I have not been an active participant.
And I take it you used the GI Bill to help pay for your education initially?
I did not.
You did not?
I did not. Back in the 80s, there really wasn't much of a GI Bill to fall on.
How about now?
But there certainly is, mm-hmm. and it's certainly tied to active service.
Yeah.
But I had completed most of my graduate studies, and I think there may have been some options after coming back from Kuwait and Saudi Arabia, but it was nothing that I had an interest in pursuing.
Okay, so Arthur, what are you doing these days?
These days, I actually work for the city of Framingham. I'm the city's community and economic development director. I've been there for about 5 years. Mm-hmm. And
I know it still sounds strange to call it the city of Framingham, even though it's been about a year now.
Yes, that's true. That's true. I've made a point to correct my staff at every turn to try to get them to make that mental transition. It's not a simple one.
But it's getting there. It is getting there.
What's kind of interesting about this role is I've been on the civilian side. I've worked in different roles in the economic development profession, really since starting as an economic development intern with the Niagara Mohawk Power Corporation back in 1990. Mm-hmm. Excuse me. A lot of what I did as a civil affairs officer was look at how communities are constructed, understand what it would take to make communities function at a baseline level, and ultimately help them function better, perform better. And there are many elements to that, not least of which is the strength and the vitality of the business community, and the strength in the robustness of infrastructure, and ultimately urban design or community design. My role in Framingham is very much touches on those themes, you know, very different kind of context, certainly a much more developed, mature, vibrant community, frankly, and certainly not one that has ever suffered the ravages of war. Mm-hmm. But that work back in the 1990s, I think, prepared me well for some of the challenges I'm helping the city wrestle with today.
Okay. Arthur, how important was it for you to serve in the military?
I think pretty important. You know, I had mentioned earlier, you know, what my experiences were and my orientation was, at least as early as third grade. I think I've always felt that freedom is not free, in that there are obligations that come separate from, you know, what the law may require. And I just felt that through military service, there was a good path for me to make a contribution. Mm-hmm.
Arthur, is there anything else you'd like to say before we wrap things up?
I guess I'd just go back to something I'd mentioned before. You know, my experience was interesting, full of irony, and a lot of humorous moments that I didn't mention. But I know, in the big scheme of things, I was a very small cog in a unit that was, frankly, far removed from a lot of the execution of the war. We didn't do anything unusual. We didn't do anything that was, except for maybe one or two occasions, life-threatening, or be in a situation where, you know, health or life was at risk. But I know that there are so few of us out there that I thought it might be a story worth sharing nonetheless.
And indeed, we do thank you so much for sharing that story. Arthur Robert, thank you for taking part in the mm-hmm. Natick Veterans Oral History Project.
Thank you.